Good morning, 7:42 here on the Mighty 690. It is time for our update from K-State Research and Extension's Wildcat District. Joining us, we have Livestock Production Agent Wendy Powell. Good morning, how are you doing?
Hi, I'm great. How are you?
You're going well, so good to have you in here. Hey, we have a couple events and that sort of thing coming up, right?
Yeah, absolutely. But first wanted to announce we are looking for a full-time nutrition educator in our independence office. So this person would be working with SNAP Ed, low-income Kansans using evidence-based strategies to achieve healthy lives and reduce health disparities. So if you're interested in something like that out of our independence office, hop on our website and there's a link there to apply.
And what kind of qualifications are you kind of looking for? You know, someone obviously familiar with that would probably be preferred, I would think.
So I don't believe this, I think it's just a associate's degree is the requirement.
Okay.
I'm not finding that right here on the real fast as we're visiting. So if you're interested, hop on that job description and it'll be there somewhere.
Great. Well, that's a good opportunity. And I mean, that's cool to be able to work with all of you. I mean, it's a fun group. You know, we always enjoy having you in.
Well, thanks.
So event-wise, what do we have coming
up? Yeah, we've got lots of events coming up. We've got a food handler serve safe training. That's going to be April 24th. We've got our Aging with Attitude Regional Expo. So that's a big deal. April 28th, and that's going to happen in Parsons. Our Dieting with Diabetes online class will start May 1st. Then there's our Kitchen Kids Camps coming up this summer. So I know my son's very much looking forward to that. So the kids actually get to go in and they prepare some food. They learn about some table setting stuff, and it's a lot of fun. So there's different locations for that. It's a 3-day camp, 2.5 hours each day, one in Fredonia, Neodesha, Coffeyville, and Oswego. So those will be a lot of fun.
Oh, excellent. No, that is really good. We appreciate you sharing all of those events. So you want to talk about some hay analysis today?
Yeah.
Forage testing, right?
Yes, absolutely. So spring is here, and it's really hard to talk about hay when we've got so much great green grass growing.
Plenty of forage, plenty of stuff, you know. Why think about that?
Yes, exactly. But now is the time to be putting our thoughts together for our strategy for this next season and how we're going to get our cows through or any of our livestock species through the next winter. I know hay supplies are practically at zero for the year. And so this year is going to be possibly even tougher than last year. So it really just depends on your situation. So knowing that going into the season, we can do some things now to prepare us for next winter. So I talked with a guy yesterday, and he's planning on forage testing his prairie hay before he sells it. And that's just such a great idea, because if folks are able to purchase a higher quality hay, then they don't have to spend as much purchasing grain or other feed products. So if you know your access to hay or to grain products, then you can match that other side and spend less money. Ideally, that's the idea.
Well, sure. And because, you know, some different hays are, you know, more nutrient dense. I mean, we have people talk about like hot hay or whatever, you know, for when they have horses or whatever, you know, you know, hay that has kind of more nutrients in it and that sort of thing. So there is going to be some differences between different qualities, right?
Yeah, absolutely. So alfalfa usually is like our premium hay. When folks think of really good hay, that's usually going to be alfalfa or an alfalfa-based hay. And that's definitely true. It's got tons of nutrition, and a lot of times we don't even have to supplement that for our beef cows, depending on how we're operating. But as we move to hays that are more inexpensive, then we just have to match our grain or our supplement needs to that forage quality. And what's really important about this is actually getting that forage tested. So what we have found in the last few years with this, the fluctuating weather patterns, the grass that's growing is not actually at our, what I'll call book value quality. So we might have this one standard for fescue or Bermuda or whatever in our books, you know, that says that it's this protein, this energy level, But what's actually growing in our hay fields and pastures is not up to that quality. Simply because it hasn't had the rain, possibly hasn't had the fertilizer, the weed control that our book situations have. So what we really have to remember is that whatever you're feeding to your animals, it needs to be tested if you want to maximize your dollars.
Sure. So how do we actually sample hay? What's the process here?
Yeah. So each of our extension offices have hay probes that folks can borrow to actually sample those. And what we do is take a core sample out of 10% of our bales and then mix all of that together and send that to a lab. And what we're looking for at the lab is a protein and an energy value. So it's not complicated. It does take some elbow grease and some muscle power because sometimes those bales are pretty tight. But you want to sample 10% of the hay in each hay lot. So that kind of gets into another complicated situation. What we call a hay lot is hay that's been treated all the same. So let's consider one hay field, but it's a really big field and it's got this maybe this creek that runs through the middle of it, so it's been managed differently, or maybe the forage species are slightly different. That's going to be two different hay lots, even though it's one hay field. Or if you've gotten the hay mowed and it got rained on, that's a different hay lot. You want to keep that separate than what was put up more pristine. So each time there's something different about your hay products, then those need to be in different lots. And you'll need to stack them separately so you can see them differently and then sample them separately so that whenever you're feeding, you can maximize that those nutritional qualities.
Gotcha.
So whenever you get your core samples out of the bales, you're going to put those into a bucket, mix it up really well, and then you're going to bring that to the extension office, and we can help you select which package you want, like what results you need. Do you need all of the minerals, magnesium, calcium, phosphorus? Do you need to know all of that? Or are you just needing the more routine and more inexpensive test? So we can help you make those decisions.
Sure. So what different kinds of analysis do they usually do on the actual samples that come in?
Yeah, a lot of times whenever we get our results back, there's this value called relative feed value. Even on it, sometimes it's on all types of hay, so prairie hay, fescue, alfalfa. And that is really for just legumes. So whenever they throw that number out there, relative feed value, it's really for just legumes. So that confuses things. What we have discovered now is a relative feed quality value, and that is more for grasses. So that is something that if you're looking for which test to run, look for the relative feed quality. But then whenever you're actually looking at the packages at the labs, it can be kind of daunting to select which one. There'll be choices like the NIRS, near infrareflective spectrometry. That test is for grasses that are a monoculture, I'll call it. So like if you have a fescue field but is not contaminated with any other weeds or any other grasses, then you can run the NIRS. A lot of times around here, our hay meadows are mixed species forage. There's legumes and grasses, which is higher quality most of the time. So we want to run the wet chemistry packages. And those tend to be a little bit more expensive, but they're more accurate. So they're more detailed, and you can get a lot better information from them. So after you decide on the testing method, then you can drop down to all of the different, you know, crude protein, energy, all of the different minerals that are an option. And of course, when we're looking at these packages, they're not going to be labeled what we see on a feed bag label. So energy will be listed as TDN, which stands for total digestible nutrients. Or it might even be listed as NEM, N-E capitalized, M lowercase, and that stands for net energy of maintenance. So there's some fact sheets, some handouts that I have at the offices that if you're interested in digging a little bit more into that, all of these different acronyms and what they mean and how they're used, I'm happy to share that information, have a conversation. It can get really complicated. The other factor that's very important is dry matter. So we can talk about energy and protein, energy and protein all day, but if we don't know the dry matter value of that hay, we don't know how watered down it is, literally. That tells us how much moisture is in the product. And so we can tell you, you know, once an animal consumes that, how much water are they getting versus how much of the actual nutrient. So those are the three big ones, is dry matter, protein, energy. But there's, as you can see on that list there, James, it's a huge list of all of the different things you can learn from a hay sample. It can be daunting.
Oh, that's a lot of information there.
Yes. So definitely if you're interested in doing something like this and maximizing your supplement cost, then go ahead and give me a call. I'm happy to help you with that.
Sure. Well, and of course, as we are thinking about all this, excuse me, I still got all this allergy stuff. So we're planning ahead for winter. And are there any rules of thumb to estimate, you know, hay needs for winter?
Yeah. So knowing what, how many animals you're going to feed and what their weight is the big thing. A lot of times we don't have access to scales, especially with our cow-calf herds. So we don't know exactly how many pounds of livestock we're trying to keep alive. So that's the first step, is at estimating your hay needs, is knowing what your animals weigh. And you can do that. You can load your animals up and drive across the scales at the local co-op or whatever, and then, you know, divide by however many head you have there, to just to get an average. So that's helpful. whenever you have all of the information from the hay analysis and you have your cow or livestock weight, then that's when you can figure your hay estimate for the winter. So a cow will eat 2.5 to 3% of their body weight each day. And then you just maximize that or multiply that by the number of days you expect to feed hay. And there are lots of things that we can do to reduce our loss through the winter. Our storage method, even the method of how the hay is baled. You know, a tighter bale is going to shed more water than a bale that's loosely wrapped. What we wrap the bale with matters. That's going to have an impact on how much deterioration you'll have in the winter.
Or if we wrap the bale.
Exactly. Yeah. You know, the old timers, they would just do stacks and the rain would just filter right on through that and the whole thing can get a little bit spoiled by spring.
Well, that's the way we've always done it. So,
right? Yeah. So there's been lots of new, I'll call them innovations, technology, with how we can wrap a bale. You know, you see those big marshmallow looking things. I saw some yesterday that were a green plastic wrap, so that was a fun color to see. But some of those have some different qualities where we're talking about haylage, and that stuff actually ensiles in the bale, which is a whole new ball game. But that definitely is more protected during the winter than bales that are just wrapped with twine.
Sure. No, absolutely. So so if people do need to, you know, go ahead and get maybe a hay sample, go on that sort of thing, and maybe they have questions about any of this to kind of prep for winter, any other thoughts on that?
Yeah, so just give me a call. I'm happy to help walk through folks through some ideas, make some plans. Now is probably the time to be thinking about getting that hay equipment maintained. Think about what your obstacles were last year to getting hay baled at the optimum plant time. So when the plant is the optimum nutrition to be harvested. Sometimes that can just be mitigated by having some equipment maintenance done beforehand. So sometimes it's just hard to get into fields because of the rain. And that's not something that we can really manage. We just have to deal with it. But we certainly want to be aware of it.
Sure. And well, you know, the other thing that you mentioned with, you know, this year potentially being another difficult year, is there anything else that we can be doing now hay-wise to maybe avoid some of the problems that we had last summer and fall and everything with the hay shortages?
Yeah. So this year, maybe think outside the box of what you can harvest. If you've got some space to go ahead and plant some annual forage, you know, some teff, some sedan grass. All of these plants have their own challenges. Sedan grass, we worry about nitrate or prussic acid. Teff is pretty expensive, but it's a really high quantity product. So let's just think outside the box of utilizing what space we have and pray for rain.
Absolutely. Yes, that's definitely something that we certainly need. So Wendy, I really appreciate you coming in and letting us know about this. And we are going to be back here in just a few. We have Jesse Gilmore as a some good topics for us. So that will be on the way here on the Mighty 690. We have 50 degrees right now in Coffeyville. And news coming up here on KGGF. Good morning, 8:11 here on the Mighty 690. Back with folks from K-State Research and Extension's Wildcat District. We have Wendy Powell and Horticulture Agent Jesse Gilmore. Good morning, Jesse. How you doing?
Good morning. Doing pretty good. Still thinking about having to file my taxes. They were just talking about that on the radio a second ago.
Yes, it's a dreaded time of year. It's always just terrible. So.
Yeah, but one of the things that I actually find interesting about the Extension Office is that we provide tax guides for farmers. So if any farmers need help filling out their taxes, you can pick up those brochures and pamphlets from any of our offices during tax season.
Well, that's good, and you kind of help to boil down some of those Byzantine tax laws. I know the tax rules, for instance, we've got a what's categorized as a family tree farm, and it's a several hundred pages worth of government documents that they have in a publication, government publication, of course, on tree farm laws and stuff. And I'm like, wow, who knew?
Yeah, and there's definitely some things that farmers need to think about. That's not my topic for today, but I just wanted to throw it out there. If anyone needs that tax information, you can get that at the Extension Office next year, because it's a little late to be doing that kind of thing now.
Sure. Well, that's a good reminder. So, but you do want to talk about some items related to wind and trees.
Yeah. So Friday, I believe it was March 31st, we had that huge windstorm, and especially here in Montgomery County, it was very bad. Lots of dust, lots of fire problems. I believe I passed at least 6 fire trucks on the way out of town as I was heading back east. And wind can cause a lot of problems for trees, too. So today I just wanted to talk a little bit about wind, what kind of problems it can cause in trees, and how you can minimize the impact of wind, because you definitely can't control the wind in Kansas. So in a lot of cases, wind, especially higher winds like we had on that Friday, upwards of 75 miles an hour, if I'm not mistaken, can cause a lot of damage in the canopy, and you need to keep an eye on that damage in order to make sure that your tree does not start decaying. There are two ways that you can really control the impact of wind on your trees. The first is to select good trees when you're planting them. This is going to come down to species and structure. And a lot of times those two things will go hand in hand. Like, for example, ornamental pears. They have brittle wood, bad structure. They are going to be very damaged. I was surprised I did not see more damage in ornamental pears across the region from that particular windstorm. Obviously, there were some, but they held up surprisingly well. But the problem with ornamental pears and certain other species of trees is that their wood gets very brittle. And you can expect a lot of limbs to fall out of trees like silver maples, pecans, as we mentioned, ornamental pears. Those are some of the more notoriously brittle woods that will cause a lot of problems in high wind situations. So you want to make sure that you are getting the right tree for the location that you want to put it. There are specific recommendations for different scenarios. You know, if you're really determined to have pecan trees, or silver maples, you want to make sure they're away from structures and people that could be hurt by any falling limbs. You also want to make sure that you are looking up when selecting trees, because you need to think about their mature size, especially if you live around power lines, because the power companies need to clear those lines, and they will not care about the health of the tree. They are concerned about the safety of the people around the power lines. So making sure that you are looking for the right tree is important. And then structure. So in woody plant growth, specifically for trees, there are two different patterns of growth. There's what's known as excurrent growth, which is traditionally what we think of when we think of trees. One strong central stem with many lateral branches going out. And then there's what's known as decurrent growth, which is multiple forking vertical stems. And decurrent growth is very disadvantageous when it comes to wind situations, because every time a tree forks, you introduce a junction where a tree can fail. The wood is typically weaker, and there can be potential decay issues if water collects in those junctions. So decurrent growth is strongly discouraged for large shade trees. If you're dealing with a smaller ornamental tree, that can definitely accommodate decurrent growth better than larger trees that would catch a lot more of the wind. You can, when you are planting trees, correct decurrent growth with early pruning. We do have a lot of pruning publications, depending on what kind of tree you're trying to grow. But in general, you want to try and encourage excurrent growth as much as possible by removing any smaller vertical stems from a fork. There are specific ways that you need to prune in order to make sure you don't potentially allow for decay to get into the tree, and we'll talk about that in just a second. You want to encourage that strong central leader as much as possible, because if you have one strong central leader, the rest of the canopy is going to go out laterally. Some trees lend themselves to decurrent growth, so you are not really going to correct a decurrent growing red bud or ornamental pear, for example. It's just built into that particular species. So instead of pruning in order to encourage a specific structure, you want to prune your canopy to make sure that it's decently open, so that it does not catch as much of that wind and potentially snap branches off. There are specific rules for pruning. The first, prune out anything that's dead. Obviously, if you're planting a new tree, that is not going to be an issue, I would hope. But then you need to look at any branches that are rubbing against each other, and then you prune out for openness and structure. That is really the best way that you can help trees that are already in the ground, because in a lot of situations, people aren't planting new trees on a property. They inherit trees from the previous owner, and a lot of times that'll be less desirable trees like silver maples. So making sure that you keep the pruning consistent, and at least every now and then you want to make sure that you prune your trees or have your trees pruned. You don't necessarily need to do it yourself, but when you prune, and especially if you have wind-damaged trees, there were a lot of, when wind comes into a canopy, the damage is always going to be pretty jagged. It's not, obviously not a clean cut, because wind is not a chainsaw or some other kind of sharp implement. So when trees have jagged wounds like that, they can't go through their healing process. Trees have a process known as compartmentalization. And so when you give a tree a clean cut, and making sure that you don't cut into something that I'll mention in a second, when you cut the branch off and it's a clean cut, the tree will go through a compartmentalization, which is walling off the outermost cells of the wound. And by doing this, even if decay gets into those outermost cells, it can't progress farther into the main trunk, the main part of the body. It's basically, you can think of it a lot like amputation. When they close up the part of the arm or leg that they have to amputate, that's basically what's going on with trees as well. When you cut back a branch, you usually need to take it all the way back to the, or at least for bigger branches, back to the trunk. And there is a part of the branch called the branch bark ridge. Sometimes it is also known as the branch collar. And if you cut into that, if you are trying to cut parallel with the trunk, you're actually going to cut into that branch collar. And if the branch collar is cut into, then it also can't go through the compartmentalization process. So you want to make sure, and it's kind of an unintuitive angle to cut at, you need to cut at an angle so that you aren't encroaching on that branch collar and the tree can go through its healing process. But that would be necessary if you had any limbs that were damaged in the wind, which I'm sure that there were. I on my way home from Girard that afternoon, I saw some oak trees in Girard completely uprooted, and the owners are very lucky that it did not fall on their house, because it was a very, very small yard. So that is one thing to keep in mind about oaks, is that in stronger windstorms, I haven't seen it very often. I think this is only the second time I've seen it happen. But oaks can uproot because they send their roots outward instead of downward. They don't have as strong of a taproot system as more common oaks are common, as more popular shade trees. So that is definitely something to keep in mind if you are putting oaks somewhere on your property. They are great trees, good for wildlife, good for shade, not really diseased all that much, but that is a structural issue to keep in mind. So you've pruned your canopy, essentially, or you've pruned your new trees. That is the best way that you can help with the wind. For smaller trees, you can also stake them, staking is usually going to be required for the first year or two. You want to make sure when you're staking that you're not potentially choking your tree out with the wire that goes around the trunk. That's mainly the best ways to avoid any potential wind damage. Good selection, which the Extension Office has information on specific trees and their growth patterns, and good pruning, which we have publications on pruning techniques and ways to keep that in mind.
Very good. Well, and something to be thinking about as we head into, you know, severe weather season. I mean, we had, like you said, winds over 75 miles an hour, and some places even got up to maybe estimated up to 90 miles an hour. So, yeah, that's something that that'll start to cause a lot of tree damage. So
yeah, and you one other thing that you can't really do anything about, but you need to keep an eye out for, is lightning strikes. If we have severe weather and lightning starts hitting, a lot of times that will split trees. And sometimes trees can recover from this. I was called out to one oak that was struck by lightning, and it seems to be doing just fine, surprisingly. But when you have a tree that is split for reasons, you know, wind, lightning, could be a number of reasons, you need to keep a very close eye on that to make sure that the wood is still solid and that it is not decayed at all. Once decay starts seeping into a tree that has been damaged like that, at that point I would consider it a hazard and you would need to have it removed. There are things you can do, and I hate telling people that they need to remove their trees. Up in Kansas City, my horticultural counterpart up there, he has stopped telling people about hazard trees because it can be seen as a liability. In my situation, I am always overly cautious when it comes to potential decay in trees. I would much rather tell people to remove a tree and have them regret removing it than have them regret not removing it, because if they regret not removing it, that means it came down on something or someone. And I do not want people to go through that. That can be a long and grueling and potentially litigious process where you're dealing with lawsuits. So it is always worth playing it safe when it comes to that kind of thing. But if there's no decay, you just need to understand what kind of structural problems can be caused by that injury to the tree. There are ways to assess the potential hazard nature of a tree. Usually if a trunk or hollow in a trunk has been rotted through more than a third of the way through, at that point it would be considered a hazard. That's not to say that it can't stand, but it is a ticking time bomb. And so when you have a point of failure, like a hollow or some part of the tree that has rotted, the tree will almost always go in the direction of the failure. So let's say, for example, if you've got a hollow or some decaying wood on the east side of a tree, especially the lower down that that point of decay is, the more likely the tree is to fail. So if the hollow is on the east side of the tree is going to fall to the east almost 100% of the time. That's not to say there aren't exceptions, but it is incredibly more likely to go in the direction that the wood is decaying, because when you're cutting a tree with a chainsaw, you wedge out a small section of the trunk in the direction that you want the tree to fall. It's a lot of the same principle, except you don't want the tree to fall, and it's likely going to fall anyway. So that is always something you want to keep an eye on if you ever see damage in your tree. You know, individual branches are probably okay, but once the problem starts getting into the trunk, you need serious consideration about potentially removing it. Sure. And you know, removing a tree sucks, but depending on the species or, you know, certain species have appeal as firewood. For example, if you needed to remove an Osage orange, that is the most dense wood you can burn. You get a lot of heat energy out of that if you have wood stoves. We also have a few timber and milling operations down here in southeast Kansas that would take specific types of wood like oak or cherry, black cherry. Walnut, too, I think a couple of them do. So depending on what species you need to remove and the quality of the timber, there might be ways that you can at least get some benefit out of having sure. to remove the tree.
A little bit of a silver lining. Kind of on the similar topic of trees, Jesse, I did hear a report that right now we have pretty elevated pollen levels in the form of tree pollen, and that's causing a lot of allergies right now. Is that just based on kind of the time of year?
Yep. Yep, 100%. I got an interesting question from someone that I still need to look into. I have not been able to find an answer for her about people who go out and collect tree pollen in order to produce allergy medicine. I do not have a good answer for that type of question, but there are people who go out and do that, which, you know, as someone who has been suffering from seasonal allergies over the last couple of years, is kind of surprising, because it's nice to know there is at least a use for the pollen, but there's not really anything you can do to minimize pollen. I guess not plant cedars, not plant oaks. Oak pollen in particular is pretty hard to see. At least with cedars, you can see them have a yellowish brown cast when they are putting out their pollen. The other thing that I would recommend in order to avoid pollen, if you really want to avoid pollen, and there's not a great way to do this with most species, but there are some that are better, is to only plant female trees, because the male trees are the only ones that are putting out the pollen. The female trees are receiving the pollen to produce fruits and seeds and things like that. So if you can find a way to buy female plants, you're going to have a lot less of those pollen issues. But you know, if you're in a more populated area, you can't control what your neighbors have or what they plant. So pollen is something we are going to be stuck with for a long time.
Yeah, and especially in this part of the country, we seem to be in the crosshairs of a lot of different pollens.
Yeah, it doesn't help that we haven't gotten a ton of rain this spring either, because the rain will, in a lot of cases, weigh down and prevent dusting of pollen. So, you know, windier situations, drier situations, the pollen is free to fly wherever it wants, or wherever the wind takes it, and oftentimes it ends up taking it into my yard. So, if we get more rain, we should see pollen issues and seasonal allergies decrease at least a little bit.
Well, maybe fingers crossed for that. Anything else you'd like to hit on this morning, Jesse?
Nope, that should do it. I'm on next week again, I believe, and I will finally be getting around to the topic of tree appraisal and figuring out the value of your trees.
Excellent. Well, good preview on that. Wendy, did you want to just let us know once again about some of the upcoming events that are going on?
Yeah, we've got lots of opportunities for some ServSafe food handling, Kitchen Kids Camp. Hop over to our website or to our Facebook, Twitter news feeds, and we've got lots of information there. And anybody that has questions about forage sampling or analysis, harvesting their hay this summer, give me a call at the Altamont office. My phone number is 620-784-5337.
All right. Well, livestock production agent Wendy Powell and horticulture agent Jesse Gilmore, thanks so much for coming on.
You're welcome.
Thank you.
All right. And we'll be back with an early bird edition of Open Line here in moments on the Mighty 690.